Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Boxing has broken noses and made dreams long before Mike Tyson's teeth closed around Evander Holyfield's ear. There was the magic of Lewis, Marciano, Frazier, and the great Ali. These real-life lords of the ring knocked out their opponents and won the hearts of fans worldwide. But times have changed. In this hour, boxing's glorious past and uncertain future. Round one, Mike Tyson. On Tuesday, the D.C. Boxing Commission took the first step toward issuing the beleaguered boxer a license to fight. James Jones is covering the story for WAMU. Earlier, I asked him why Nevada turned Tyson down and what led him to the nation's capital.
Things seemed to be on track in Nevada until the little incident in New York City when Mike Tyson and Lennox Lewis were introduced at a press conference. Of course, there was a scuffle, people swinging, a claim that Tyson bit Lennox Lewis in the leg. A big mess that made the Las Vegas guys think, you know, maybe this isn't such a good idea. I'm not sure how much the pending rape charges against Mike Tyson had to do with their decision to not grant him a license. But as you know, just yesterday it was announced that those charges were dropped. But yeah, he was rejected in Nevada, and most people felt it was because Mike Tyson proved himself to be an unreliable character once again.
How did he get to Washington, and what's going on there now?
Well, actually, the state of Georgia did issue him a license to box, and that was prior to him coming to Washington. Washington, to a certain extent, Washington reached out to him. As soon as Nevada turned it down, the boxing commission in Washington made the relevant inquiries and said, hey, we're interested in having Mike Tyson here to box. In Atlanta, of course, the governor Roy Barnes of Georgia, called Tyson a sexual predator and said, we don't need a person like that in our state. That kind of made the Tyson people shy away from there. Washington, it was a little bit of a surprise, I think, to people, but he made the inquiry. The Boxing Commission made the inquiry to Tyson first, and he said, yeah, I'm interested, and they said, come on in and apply. And the way boxing commissions work, while there are some requirements, mainly intended, at least in the past, to protect the health of the fighter, when the Boxing Commission says, yeah, we'll take your application, in most cases it means you are going to be licensed to fight here in the District of Columbia.
And they're going to test him and submit him for psychological tests. What do they hope they will find? What's a psychological test of Michael Tyson, Mike Tyson, apt to find?
I'm not sure what it's apt to find. It will be very interesting. And the Boxing Commission is considering this. Now, just today, I spoke with the vice chairman of the Boxing Commission. He said they are considering psychological tests. Now, that's very interesting because most boxing commissions, including the Boxing Commission for the District of Columbia, do not administer a psychological test. And so I'm not sure what those questions are going to be. And it'll be, I would say, probably a first in the nation, perhaps a model. But I don't think so. Quite honestly, I think that is the psychological test is going to be him coming in for an interview and talking with them and them making a judgment about his mental state.
I can imagine giving him a Rorschach test and the images that he would find in the blotters.
It would certainly be an interesting test to see if he is just simply in control of himself.
Right.
If he just made something up that wasn't controversial, they would probably pass him.
Right. Okay. Now, this has divided Washington on almost racial and class lines. Tell us about this. That is the decision to have the fight there.
Yeah, this is a very interesting point, and it's actually still it's a point of contention. Some people will say this is not divided on race lines or not, but the fact of the matter is the vice chairman of the commission, Mike Brown, who happens to be the son of former Commerce Secretary Ron Brown, He was the one who actually got the ball rolling, because in the very first press conference when people were criticizing Mike Tyson, he said, you know, Washington's a big city with a lot of neighborhoods. It's not just the White House. It's not just Congress. Some people like to go to the Kennedy Performing Arts Center. Some people want to see a heavyweight fight. And with that comment, it just kicked off this whole race class discussion. Once again, I mean, Washington, just to go back a little bit, I mean, Washington is a city that has been completely divided, at least politically, by race for a very long time. Marion Barry was a very polarizing character, the former mayor of Washington, who is infamous for being busted for smoking crack cocaine on television, on tape at least. It ended up on television. But the new mayor, a guy named Anthony Williams, is sort of in the classic mode of the so-called technocrat mayor. And he seems to be a guy. His support came from largely from the wealthy and white community. Mm-hmm. But we haven't had that same tone of racial politics. The city council has turned over, and it used to be the first thing out of somebody's mouth was, you know, you guys don't understand because you're not from our neighborhood. And that's what Mike Tyson has brought back to the District of Columbia. Everybody has an opinion, and it is, you know, pretty sharply divided on racial and economic lines. Now, I mean, you talk about the reasons for having the fight. I mean, the mayor of the city, Anthony Williams, a guy who's immensely popular, was someone who people were looking to for leadership. And he basically said, we should not close the door to this fight. And mm-hmm. I don't think anybody would say that D.C., Washington, D.C., should not have a heavyweight fight. Mm-hmm. They definitely mm-hmm. should. It would be great. The tourism industry mm-hmm. has been down. But the fact of the matter is we wouldn't even have had a shot at this fight if it wasn't for Mike Tyson and the fact that he was being rejected. So mm-hmm. it's a very mm-hmm. strange situation where the mayor says we need to seize this opportunity mm-hmm. because it's there, mm-hmm. but it's an opportunity that would not have been there had Mike Tyson not been involved and not been rejected by others. It's very strange.
Now the National Organization for Women, City Council member Sharon Ambrose, and others are protesting this fight just on grounds that he's not a worthy person to have represented in such a Klieg-like way. Has the Boxing Commission just pushed all that aside? Or?
Well, the Boxing Commission's next big test will be March 12th when they have a public hearing on the matter. As far as those opinions, of course, there's no one in this city who would walk around and say that anybody isn't entitled to their opinion. Their response has basically been, yes, we knew there was going to be opposition to this, but we also know that there's a lot of support for this. Now, the women's groups, I'm not sure how. Well, first of all, the city council cannot stop the fight. It's going to have to come down to public pressure. Mm-hmm. And a boxing commission is an interesting thing because they're in the business of promoting boxing. And this is undeniably a once in a lifetime opportunity for the district to put itself on the map as a boxing capital. Mm. And I find it very difficult, and I think a lot of other people do, to believe that the pressure from these groups is going to have a heck of a lot of impact on the situation.
James Jones is a reporter for WAMU. He spoke to us from Washington. We're talking this hour about boxing. The sweet science is revered or reviled, depending on what generation you're from. What do you see when you look in the ring? Beauty or brutality? What are your memories of the great fights? Should boxing go down for the count? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me in the studio is Wilbert Skeeter McClure. In 1960, he was captain of the U.S. Olympic boxing team and won a gold medal in Rome. One of his teammates was a brash fighter from Kentucky, Cassius Clay. Now, Skeeter McClure is a psychologist and a former Massachusetts State Boxing Commissioner. Welcome, Skeeter McClure.
Thank you, Jack.
Skeeter McClure, say the good of boxing for us. What did the sport do for you, and what has it done for others?
Well, good question. And it's a question that's never asked hardly these days. But I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for boxing. Muhammad Ali certainly wouldn't be where he is today if it wasn't for boxing. Lennox Lewis and a lot of other guys, Joe DiNucci, our state auditor, boxed. And you have boxers, former boxers who are judges, who are physicians, who are dentists, who are ministers. And boxing gives people who, you know, live in tough circumstances, mm-hmm. and it gives you a way out. And through boxing, I was able to leave the projects in Toledo, Ohio, and a very working class town with, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, hard workers, and take my first plane ride, stay in my first hotel, eat in the first restaurant in which they had more than a spoon and a knife and a fork, and so many types of goblets and glasses that I didn't know what they were to do, to see foreign countries, to see big cities in this country, all before I was 19 years old. And so it was an education for me in many ways, and it's a good activity. I couldn't ask for better preparation for life, because the boxing community, as you know and as most people know, it's sort of sordid in some ways. And as a young man observing, listening, I got a real good picture when I was young about life. So I wasn't naive about what life is like. I know that fights were stolen from you. They take fights from you. And the same thing with jobs in the corporate world. You know, they'll hire or promote someone else over someone who's more qualified.
Yeah.
And so you learn that there are that tough people, people with scars in their faces, people who are ugly, to be frank, are nice in their hearts. You don't judge people by what you see. You learn that, and you learn that big tough guys with lots of muscles, you can beat them easily if you got a good brain on your shoulder. You know what you're doing. So all these contrasts are many, many lessons that I learned through boxing and other fighters as well.
Can you give us a brief review of your career?
Yes, I was started in 1953, and I was a bantamweight.
What weight is that?
That's 118 pounds. Mm-hmm. And I boxed. I'm from Toledo, Ohio, mm-hmm. and my first fight was in Lima, Ohio, and I won one that night, and I lost one that night. And I was driving home in the rain with my mother and father in the front seat, and I was crying in the back seat. And I was saying, I'll never be any good, and I'll never be any good. And they were so nice, my mother and father. And they said, you'll be all right. And what I was doing, I was foreclosing my future based upon one loss, one night, the first time out, which is stupid. Mm-hmm. You know, so you learn these things. So I boxed in Toledo, and I won some city championships, some local championships, and I didn't hit my stride until a white Irish cop, Buddy Carr, saw me at a football game my senior year at high school and asked me to come to his gym. And he said, if you come to my gym, Skeeter, when you walk in, I'll give you all my attention. And I said, you will? And he said, yes. And he kept his word. And under his tutelage, I won two national AAU championships, two national Golden Gloves championships. I won the Pan American Games gold medal, and the next year I won the gold medal in the Olympics. And so he taught me, and he was with me every step of the way. And he owns 50% of my gold medal. It's not all mine, because you can only do what you're taught. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that my teacher was better than the teachers of my opponents.
And he was with you throughout your career?
Yes, not as a pro, but as an amateur.
Yes.
I should have kept him as a pro, too. I'd have done something without making some money.
And you retired when?
I retired in 68. I fought on national TV. I was number 3 in the world as a pro in 1963. But due to management ineptitude, they rushed me too fast. It wasn't like it was today. You know, they didn't have closed circuit then, and it was like Madison Square Garden was the only show in the world. And they mismatched me too much with too many hard, you know, more advanced fighters than I should have fought. Nowadays, you can fight hams up to the time you fight for the title. But
and medically, problems that way from boxing?
None. No.
And even when you were fighting?
No, I was telling one of the producers out there that I've testified to so many committees and on radio and on TV. Because every 6 or 7 years, the AMA would want to abolish boxing for health reasons. And I've been on so many shows coast to coast, you know, TV and radio. And I testified up in New Hampshire because one of the representatives wanted to abolish boxing in New Hampshire. And they had these physicians with their slides and their all their equipment, and they were talking about how dangerous boxing was. And so when it was my turn to testify, and I said, well, we have to look at what the real thing is. And it's like, I've, You know, I've boxed all these years. I've been knocked down. I've suffered all the things they've talked about. But somehow my mental faculties were such that I could get a bachelor's degree.
And we're going to come back to your bachelor's degree.
Okay.
We're talking about the future of boxing at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Gentlemen, if you please, this is a private fight. The Marquess of Queensbury rules will be observed on all occasions.
Yeah, well, the Marquess of Queensbury rules, mind you now, Squire.
Okay with me, McAleen.
Non-belligerents will kindly remain in neutral. Now, shake hands and come out fighting. I thank you.
Do you hear that, everybody? The Marquess of Queensbury rules.
No, the Marquess of Queensbury rules.
Marquess of Queensbury rules.
That is a scene from The Quiet Man, John Ford's epic film. And we're talking this hour about the future of boxing. You can reach us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest, Skeeter McClure, fought his first fight in Lima, Ohio in 1953. Skeeter McClure, what were the Marquess of Queensbury rules, and what was boxing like before them?
Before it was vicious, and only a nut, I think, would box in those days because there were really no rules. There were no gloves at the beginning, and you can hit a guy anywhere you want to hit him except in this, you know, private parts and stuff. And knockdowns were counted when an opponent was hit when his knee touched the ground. And so you'd have fights of 75 rounds because they would be like sometimes 1 minute, sometimes 5 minutes, you know. But it was rough, very, 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 very tough, and very brutal,
and
in my opinion.
Who was the Marquess of Queensbury, and what were the rules?
Well, you know, the Marquess of Queensbury was a guy over in, I think, I forget where he's from.
But, Britain, I think.
Yeah, Britain. But the rules standardized it. Rounds 3 minutes each,
mm-hmm.
wearing gloves, boxing gloves, certain weights, and blah, blah, blah. Mouthpiece,
mm-hmm.
and if you're knocked down, the person knocks the other one down. He has to go to a neutral corner.
Mm-hmm.
Before, and Jack Dempsey lost the fight because you stood over your opponent, and as soon as he raised up, you could clock him really.
Mm-hmm.
Which so these kind of rules that
mm-hmm.
they had in place that helped with the safety and to help fighters fight longer, I presume.
Mm. Yeah. Was John L. Sullivan post Marquess of Queensbury or before?
He was about on the cusp of it.
Yeah. With us now on the line is Charlie Pierce. He's a weekly contributor to Only a Game and a writer at large for Esquire magazine. Hi, Charlie.
Jack, I thought I'd add a little historical tidbit to this. The Marquess of Queensbury, among other things, was the man whose son was at the center of the controversy involving Oscar Wilde.
That's right.
And the Marquess of Queensbury was the person who made the insult that prompted Oscar Wilde to file the slander lawsuit, which eventually resulted in his destruction as a public person.
So. That's right, and he's portrayed by Tom Wilkinson in the film Wilde.
But that is, by the way, the same Marquess of Queensbury.
Yes, it is. Well, Charlie, does boxing need a new Marquess of Queensbury to reform it?
Well, a better one hopes, than that guy. But, you know,
I guess I'm asking, can it recover from Mike Tyson?
I think that we have. Oh, it has recovered from the mob. It's recovered. You know, it's recovered from fixed fights. It's recovered from guys getting killed. Mike Tyson is a slightly more than venial sinner. He's a bit of a carnival act now, and that's the problem with him. He discovered he could have a lucrative career as being Mike Tyson the Fighter without ever getting to the ring and actually fighting anyone. The interesting thing about this, politically to me, Jack, is that, to me, boxing is the perfect example of what Republican and conservative politicians like to call devolution of the federal function, which is that you let everything go back to the states and let the states run everything because they're better at it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, it seems to be, outside of the military, the only thing that the conservatives seem to want to coordinate under the federal government. which is what John McCain, my good friend from Arizona, where I am now, you know, has been lobbying for a national boxing czar for years and years and years. Now, the problem with that is, of course, that how do you enforce loyalty to whoever the national boxing czar is?
Mm-hmm.
So boxing has always been, and Skeeter knows, and every writer will tell you, there are far more interesting stories in boxing than there are in practically any other sport. Boxing has always been sort of the repository of all the mortal sins of all the other sports.
How do you mean?
Well, because every other sport, anything that happens in their particular bailiwick that's degrading or immoral or corrupt, they can always point to boxing and say, see, we're not boxing. So boxing serves this sort of scapegoat function, I think, for the national sports, and I think it always will.
Thank you, Charlie.
does that resonate with you, Steve?
Absolutely, absolutely. Well put.
It's sort of like...
I'm being facetious.
It's sort of like the athletic equivalent of Mississippi.
Well, to an extent, absolutely. But, I'm being facetious, but there certainly are issues to be resolved in terms of what happens to fighters after they're done fighting. Actual licensing, actual medical boards with actual medical practices in which a guy who's had four concussions can't get a license to fight anywhere.
Can he get a license now?
Well, yeah, he can. That's what I mean.
Mm.
These are the issues that have to be dealt with. Real medical databases that are accurate. Perhaps we can't wring all the all the foul water out of the sponge, but we can get more of it than we do now.
What about this, Skeeter McClure? Real medical data. Boxers now fight with severe life-threatening injuries, and they're allowed to?
Yes. When I was chairman of the commission up here, we suspended permanently the license of four fighters, and they were just deteriorating. Two from out of state and two were from this state. And we walked to the dressing room after the fight and we said, this is it. You've done well. You've given a lot to boxing over the years, but you're going to suspend you permanently on medicine. So we shot this stuff out throughout the country. And oddly enough, one of them out of state, we got a letter from his attorney. And his attorney wanted us to lift his suspension, just limited to Massachusetts. And we told him on no uncertain terms, no, this fighter doesn't need to fight
anymore. Did any of the four get licensed elsewhere? Do you know?
I don't know, but I know they tried. I don't have the data.
How badly? What was wrong?
They weren't walking their heels, but the speech was slurred, mm-hmm. more and more and more, and their reflexes were going, mm-hmm. like not able to parry jabs to get out of the way of right hands. Their movements were sluggish, mm-hmm. lateral movements,
mm-hmm.
and so we keep our eye on fighters who come here and they don't seem to be able to protect themselves much anymore. But this is not true across the country, and I think mm-hmm. Charlie's right in a way. The boxing commissions are something else. They're political,
mm-hmm.
and so when you look, that's one of the reasons I left the commission, because it's a political mm-hmm. thing, and it's unwieldy. New York, they had a big expose a couple of years ago. I don't know if you saw that, Charlie, a couple of years ago.
No, I missed this one.
But it was a humongous expose for several months in the New York Post. And how corrupted was the commission there?
Trainers and managers would off.
Yes, in some ways, mm-hmm. yes. But it's tough, and I don't know. I'm trying to straddle the fence in a way, because I don't know if you I don't know of a fighter who would want to change it. I've never heard anything coming from the fighters to change it.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that gives boxing its aura, mm-hmm. and its drawing power, whatever is left of it, is the fact that it's a tough business.
Mm-hmm.
And to stay in it and to advance in it, you have to be a tough man in many, many, many ways.
Mm-hmm.
People wanted to start a few years ago. They wanted to make some money by having some kind of retirement fund. But this was just some businessmen, people who wanted to rake off some money. That's all it was. Mm. So I said, forget it. We're not going to back it.
Mm.
So that's all that was. And most fighters are four-rounders, six-rounders, eight-rounders.
Mm-hmm.
And they fight maybe 2 years or 3 years. They're not going to make any money. They're going to have any money in the fund.
Sure.
So forget it.
We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dusty is on the line. Hello.
How you doing? Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I just like to make a comment. I'm 53, and I think I was blessed, and you might get different opinions, that, ever since I was 14 and listening on a shortwave radio to Ali fighting in Florida, and just the the pregame stuff and just following him for his whole career. And I even got to see him once live in Madison Square Garden when he fought Shavers. But, you know, I grew up in West Springfield. I'm sure Skeeter McClure, there used to be fights there in the Coliseum. And and Ali trained in Chicopee before he went up to Lewiston and everything. But, you know, that was kind of like the Renaissance. I mean, he would bring, if anybody, you know, it's too bad a lot of people, you know, just didn't get a chance to really appreciate this person because he was, you know, I'm just blessed, I think, to just watch his career. And you know, certainly at the end that he's kind of paid for it.
Well, I think, you know, he's such an interesting phenomenon in that he has in a lot of ways transcended the sport, and in other ways he's, including the way his physical condition now, he's so typical of it. I mean, he in his own way was bled dry. He was bled dry by a different group of hustlers, these in the guise of religion in a lot of ways, but he certainly, as a world figure, you know, like nobody else has except maybe Joe Louis, and I'm not old enough to remember that, used boxing to sort of transcend transcend the sport itself into the kind of, you know, worldwide, and it's not even celebrity, it's something deeper than that that we associate with him.
Let's get Skeeter McClure, who actually has a memory of, sure, of Cassius Clay. He was your teammate in the 1960 Olympics. Tell us about it.
Well, he was an ordinary fighter. I knew him in 57, 58, 59, and we were on a couple of teams in 59, and we were on the Olympic team, of course, in 1960. And he was a nice fellow, young man, and a teenager, the youngest of all. We were all 20, in our 20s, early 20s. But when he turned professional, he was such a great self-promoter. Mm-hmm. And what I liked about him, and what I think the world likes about him and appreciates about him, is he was not a mean, nasty, evil self-promoter. Mm-hmm. He was wholesome, mm-hmm, and he was playful. And of course, there were some moments when he had some problems, like with the draft and with the Nation of Islam and so forth. But by and large, he was a pleasant fellow who grabbed babies and held them, loved kids to death, and kissed them and stuff. And that resonated with the people. Mm-hmm. That resonated with them. And I think that's something that. And he was the first one that started the pre-fight brawls at the weigh-ins. But again, they weren't malicious. They were like put on things, you know.
He wasn't biting anybody.
No. But these guys, they are like different.
I remember that 1960 Olympics. He was thin.
Yeah.
He was agile. And did he win a gold medal?
Yes, he did.
Mm. Do you remember that fight at all, Skeeter?
Did he win a gold medal? Yes,
he did.
Of course he won a gold medal, of course. No, he was a good boxer. And he was way above all of his opponents, mm, because he had what no other fighter had. He had height, reach, slimness, and speed.
Mm.
And you got that. And it's hard to hit him. It's hard to hit him, and he finds it easy to hit you because you're there all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but he was a great phenomenon for the game. Mm. I think he resuscitated after many years under Floyd Patterson.
Mm. Floyd Patterson was the heavyweight champion before him.
Yes.
And from a purely boxing standpoint, and Skeeter can speak to this too, it was a real renaissance in the heavyweight division, which has always been the division that drives the sport. At that time, you had Ali, you had Frazier, you had George Foreman, and then you had people like Ernie Shavers and, mm-hmm, Ken Norton,
mm-hmm,
and even George Tuvalo, who were, mm-hmm, all, you know, mm-hmm, much more gifted, I think, than most of the heavyweights around today.
Thank you.
The boxing is being driven today, and has been, I think, since the 70s and 80s, by the middleweight classes.
Yes, yes.
By the light heavies and the, you know, from Roberto Duran and Thomas Hearns and Marvin Hagler up to now to Roy Jones and Bernard, mm-hmm, Hopkins.
You're right. You're absolutely right. It's like. But what bothers me is that the middleweight championship fight a few weeks ago, with what's the guy's name?
Trinidad and Hopkins?
No, not that one. They had to move it from the big room in Madison Square Garden to the 5,000 seat.
Mm-hmm.
And two great fighters, and they couldn't pack it. Now Ray, mm, Robinson and LaMotta. Mm. DeMarco and Basilio, they would have packed Madison Square Garden, you know?
So is it only the big heavyweight fights that draw the crowds?
The heavyweight division, when it's yeah, functional, which it hasn't been, yeah, in years, drives boxing professionally.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it's still the heavyweight championship of the world is still one of those titles that that sort of like rings with people deeper than the average, you know, NBA championship trophy or something. When you walk around and you know, this is the undisputed heavyweight champion of the world. Now, we haven't had one of those in a while, but it's still a, you know, it's still, that's the, you know, if you're looking for the shivers in the sport, that's where it is.
Mm-hmm. You say we haven't had an undisputed champion. What do you mean?
Well, it's hard to know. Has there been an undisputed champion, Skeeter? I don't remember one.
Not in decades.
Yeah, it's been divided up between Tyson and Lewis and Douglas and Michael Moore was the heavyweight champion of the world and some, you know, this welter of governing bodies we have. Mm-hmm. You know, almost play and almost have prizes.
Mm-hmm. Mm. The picture of boxing that we have in America, as you say, is one of upward mobility, and you know, and sort of the poor guy, whether he's John L. Sullivan, whether he's the Jewish boxers, whether he's the African American boxers, the Italian boxers, that there's a sort of moment in American immigrant history, and I mean immigrant too to the northern cities, where boxing is the opening. That's one image, and then the other image is of the fix, is of the, you know, the sordid part of it, as you say, and yet it's striking to me that American movies, from Champion to Golden Boy to The Harder They Fall, Requiem for a Heavyweight, American films about boxing are all about the honor of the boxer.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's all about, I think they're all, this is up to and including Raging Bull, which was a magnificent full film about a pretty revolting guy, Jake LaMotta. It's all about looking for the purity in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look at this and you say to yourself, as optimistic human beings, look, this thing is so brutal. Why does anybody do it? The reason they do it, there has to be some fundamental core of purity as to why somebody would put themselves through what this is. I mean, I always tell people who talk about boxers and athletes, just shadow box for 3 minutes. And now think about doing that for 15 minutes in front of a guy who's trying to take your head off.
Right.
You know,
right.
There must be a reason why somebody does this. And we don't like to think of ourselves as being, you know, fundamentally vicious and stupid. So we say somewhere at the heart of the story must be immoral.
Well, you know, back when I started, Charlie, boxing was a predominant. The NFL wasn't as big as it is. The NBA wasn't as big as it is. Major League Baseball was big, but a lot of places didn't have. There was TV was just getting started, and so there were all kinds of opportunities for boxers to do something if they didn't fit into one of those other sports, and it drew big people because people there are plenty of people who still remember the Depression. And unlike what people say about boxing, it's like if the reason people used to box is because they wanted to eat, and so it was a tough business, and they did it because they can eat. Now, for me and Ray Robinson and other people, it was a way to get some notoriety, to get some recognition, to become somebody. And there's no way in the world I could become a football player with my size.
Become somebody. Let's hold that thought. Yeah. Do you think boxing is on the ropes today? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
Well, who could knock out most with a jab? It was Sonny. Who could stand on his head without his hands? It was Sonny. Yeah, Sonny could lick all them cats. Yeah, Sonny could lick all them cats. Well, no one knew when he was born, and no one knew when he died, and no one saw the phantom punch and all the fat cats lied. But Sonny could lick all them cats. It was Sonny. Sonny could.
I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
We're trying to get in here to talk to Ali, who has retained his title, and I think he needs a little air because this has to have been one of the most bruising heavyweight championships of all time.
That was sound from the Thriller in Manila, Ali versus Frazier 3 in 1975. We're talking about the future of boxing at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK with Charlie Pierce of Esquire magazine and Skeeter McClure, a former bantamweight fighter of repute. What was the thriller in Manila, and why was that a great fight?
Well, the thriller in Manila was one of a series of great fights that that Ali had with Joe Frazier. And when you want to look at classic fights, you want to look at the three Frazier-Ali fights. Mm-hmm. They were awesome. And what makes them so memorable is that both men heard the knock at the door from death, I think.
In the fights.
Yes, because they were some of the most brutal, most challenging battles that fighters can undergo. And both of them almost hurt each other very, 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 very badly.
Yeah, I think that the tragedy of the thrill in Manila was really sort of a three-act play, the first five rounds, the second five rounds, the third five rounds. Ali won the first five, Frazier won the middle, and Ali, through sheer force of whatever there was in him, managed to survive to end the fight. But one of the tragic things about that fight, I think, was that both men were not much, but just enough over the hill. So they really did each other damage.
Mm-hmm.
They were not in their prime. They were just past it. They were just past it far enough so that. And Skeeter's right. Ali swears to this day that it's the closest he's ever been to dying was at the end of that fight.
Mm.
If you see him at the end of the fight, he can't get off the stool.
Mm-hmm.
And the only reason that Joe Frazier doesn't come out is that Yank Durham, his trainer, looked at him and realized that he was completely incapable of defending himself.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, if you want to see both the brutality and the beauty of boxing, watch the last three rounds of that fight.
Mm.
Because Joe Frazier, something in him simply cannot, he can't keep from coming forward.
That's
he just can't stop himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Ali can hit him just enough to do real damage.
Mm. And real damage was done. Let's take a call from Debbie. Hello, Debbie.
Hey.
Welcome.
I can't believe I'm on the air with I remember the boxer that's on now, but I was calling about Mike Tyson, and I've been a boxing fan since the 60s, loved Ali, Frazier, Foreman, Holyfield, and paid for a lot of Mike Tyson fights. won't pay for this one. I remember vaguely a story that he was going to be a host or a co-host for the Worldwide Wrestling Foundation, and even they turned him down because he's beyond a circus act, I think, at this point in his career.
Did you see the fights where he bit people?
Oh, yeah.
Let's be accurate, Jack. There's only one fight where he bit somebody, but
okay.
It was twice.
But it was
sorry.
Two bites.
One fight with two bites, with one bite.
I'm sorry, Debbie.
And then there was the pre-fight with the bite. So
right.
Yes.
It's really sad because I love boxing, and I don't feel like there's anyone out there that I'm willing to pay $50 at this point to watch, and that's what it is.
So I'll tell you the truth. The last fight that really I watched that really sort of had me sit upright and smack my forehead, and this is a long time ago now, believe it or not, was Buster Douglas and Mike Tyson, because it was the last time I watched a fight and literally could not believe what I was seeing. Because I'd seen Buster Douglas fight on an undercard a year earlier, and he was a bum. He was terrible. He was out of shape. He was lazy. He didn't care. And he came out that night and was perfect. He was every bit as perfect as any athlete I've ever seen.
And after he beat Tyson, he went back to his...
He couldn't get it back.
He went back to his usual style.
Whatever that was he had on that night, he couldn't get it back again.
Well, that was the time. You know, I told a lot of guys, they called Mike Tyson great at that time. I said he's not great because he hasn't been hurt yet. He hasn't fought hurt, like knocked down and had an eye
right.
split open. But Buster Douglas was the first fighter who wanted to beat Mike Tyson. The rest of them didn't. They knew they weren't going to beat him. They didn't want to beat him. They wanted the money. The 391-second endings of former champions that he fought, they didn't want to fight that man. But Buster Douglas wanted to beat him, and he did. Holyfield wanted to beat him, and he did. And I think my friend over in London, Lennox Lewis, he wants to beat him, and he will. That's the way it is. Because Mike Tyson just doesn't have it.
He doesn't have it. Debbie, thank you for that call. Mike is on the line. Hello.
Yeah, well, I guess boxing has a number of problems, but I think one of them is it's an early victim of deregulation, kind of free market ideology. Boxing, I think, was a lot better off in the after World War II and through the 50s when it was controlled by the mob. And the key word there is controlled. There were 8 weight divisions. There was one champion per each division. You know, these days, you know, there's what, half a dozen, there's about a championship for every ounce and a half. There's about 6 or 7 equally phony sanctioning organizations, and it's not, and of course it's all done to satisfy cable TV so that they can advertise a quote unquote mm-hmm. championship fight mm-hmm. every no matter how bogus. And you know, it's not just that they somehow can't get around to agreeing on one champion per weight division. They don't want to. Mm. They have an absolute economic. They couldn't exist. They need their cut.
The cable TV.
Right, right. And every once in a while, some great fighter like Marvin Hagler in middleweights, or Frazier or Ali or whoever, or Lennox Lewis could easily do it, I think. Actually, against all odds, actually cleans up all the other sort of bogus champions, and then the sanctioning bodies, all 6 of them, are outraged. They immediately conspire to come up with some phony excuse why they can defrock the champion and go back to there, because then they each get their sanctioning
right.
cut.
Let's try that on Skeeter McClure. Skeeter, we're gone from the mob to the cable people?
Well, I was listening to the caller, and I was thinking that it's a good thing he wasn't a professional boxer back in those days when he wouldn't have a shot at making a buck because the mob determined who would make the bucks. But certainly he has a good point, and we've known this for decades, that this emergence of all these sanctioning bodies mm-hmm. has corrupted the game, and certainly all these TV shows and cable shows showing boxing, it kills the sport in many ways, because they're put up there before they're ready to fight mm-hmm. on TV. So you see guys that, believe me, would not have made well in the lower Golden Gloves in 1958. Fighting on TV, making out of money, and it happens all over the country, and so that's what's hurting boxing in many ways.
Yeah.
Because the product is bad because it doesn't have a chance to develop.
Mm.
It just can't do
mm-hmm.
it,
mm-hmm.
and so that's one of the problems that confront us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Charlie, have you seen much of that? Boxers fighting before their time, before they're ready.
Well, I think Skeeter's right. I think a lot of boxers do not have the, you know, now there were fighters with 30 and 40 fight apprenticeships in the old days. I think a lot of fighters get promoted into what are really mock championship fights before they're ready. I think that's certainly accurate. I wouldn't be too sentimental about the old days with the mob, though. It rings a little bit like all those stories about, you know, the Robin Hood impulses of Whitey Bulger and how much safer the neighborhoods were when the mafia ran it. You know. Let's not forget the fixed mobs and bleeding bodies in the alleys either.
Right, right.
I want to thank you both. Wilbert Skeeter McClure, he was the 1960 Olympic gold medalist, a former Massachusetts boxing commissioner, now a psychologist. Thank you very much. And Charlie Pierce, weekly contributor to Only a Game and writer at large for Esquire. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks.
Okay.
I say boxing's been good to me. Well, sometimes I punch myself. Has boxing been good? Has boxing been good?
In 1970, Muhammad Ali fought Jerry Quarry in Atlanta. It was Ali's first fight back since being banned from the sport for evading the draft. At the time, George Plimpton was a second-string boxing reporter for Sports Illustrated. Reading now from his book Shadowbox, Plimpton describes the scene in Ali's training room in the moments before the fight.
"Who goes into the ring first?" Muhammad Ali asked. "Quarry," he was told. He lay down on the rubbing table, his head to the wall. One of the young interns leaned forward and brashly asked Ali what he was thinking just at that instant. And Ali began his litany. He said he was thinking about the people in Japan and Turkey and Russia, all over the world, how they were beginning to think about the fight and about him, and the television sets being clicked on and the traffic jams in front of the closed-circuit theaters, and how the big TV trucks out in the back of the Atlanta arena just by the stage door were getting their machinery warmed up to send his image by satellite to all those people, and how he was going to dance for them. "I got to dance," he said, all this in the soft, silky voice he uses when he does this sort of thing, almost the voice of a mother soothing her child to sleep with nursery rhymes. "How about a verse?" the intern asked. "Quarry, sorry," Ali said. The intern was delighted. "Hey, that's pretty short," he said. "How about another?" "I don't have time to find a rhyme," Ali replied gently. And he went on with his thoughts, how finally he was thinking most of all of Allah, his God, the Almighty Allah, who had given him so many gifts. He began to enumerate them in his sing-song voice, a long free-verse ode to carrot juice, to honey, to the things which grew in his garden and which he ate, never anything man-made that came in tin cans, none of that stuff, but only what came fresh from the gardens, and then the woods in which he would run before the cars were up in their poison. And he talked about how he would face east and thank the Creator for all of this which had given him strength to live right and to pray right. He said that thinking of all that the Creator had done made it simple for him to look at Quarry and see how little he was and how easy he could be whooped. Ali began to shadowbox in earnest, throwing quick long jabs, flurries of combinations and big hooks that seemed to shutter the air in that tiny room. The onlookers flattened themselves back against the wall to give him room. He stopped to tape his shoelaces against the top of his shoes so they wouldn't flop. "Too loose," he said. "In late rounds, they can get soggy, and man, I want to dance." The door burst open, and Sidney Poitier, the actor, rushed in. The champion jumped for him, and the two spun around the room in an embrace. "Sidney's here. I'm really ready to rumble," Ali shouted. He held him off at arm's length and looked at the slim actor, elegantly got up in a tight, form-fitting gray suit. "Man, you exercise?" he asked admiringly. "Hey," he said, "give me a rhyme to psych Quarry when we're getting the referee's instructions." He held up an imaginary microphone. Poitier bent his head in thought. He had been caught by surprise. "You met your match, chump," he intoned in a soft voice. "Tonight you're falling in..." He cast an arm desperately for a rhyme for chump. "You're falling in two," he cried, giving up. "That's terrible," Muhammad Ali said. "Man, you stick to acting and leave me the rhyming and the psyching." Poitier wished him luck amidst the laughter and disappeared. Ali reached for a towel and began to rub off the Vaseline. "Is the ring nice?" he asked. "Perfect," Dundee said. "Is the closed-circuit system okay?" "They say it is." Outside, the voice of the crowd, impatient now, began to beat at the door. A big roar went up. "Quarry," someone said. "Quarry is gone." Seconds to go. Ali stood immobile for a second, perhaps to pray, which is his habit. And Jesse Jackson hopped off the rubbing table and embraced him, almost trembling with emotion. A knock sounded at the door. "It's time," a voice called. Muhammad Ali gave one last peek at himself in the mirrors, and he went out into the corridor, his people packed around him.
That was George Plimpton reading from his 1977 book, Shadowbox. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is W.